Hello, this is William Fink of Christogenia.org, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, June 13th, 2025. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, I am going to present part 34 of our commentary on Isaiah, and this is the Assyrian captivity of Judah, a sort of mundane or maybe boring title, but that's just what it is. As we hope to have illustrated in our last two presentations of Isaiah, discussing chapters 34 and 35, the wrath of Yahweh shall come upon Edom on account of the controversy of Zion. And the consequences of that controversy today are reflected in the fact that for the last 2,000 years and longer, the children of Edom have been masquerading as the children of God, pretending to be Judah or even Israel when they are certainly not of Judah or Israel. So now, for the most part, the prophecies against Judah and Israel, which had warned them of the coming Assyrian captivities, are completed, and Isaiah becomes more historical in nature, here in chapters 36 through 39. These chapters contain Isaiah's record of the Assyrian captivity of Judah and the siege of Jerusalem, which failed because Yahweh had promised to defend Jerusalem as birds flying in an earlier prophecy found in Isaiah chapter 31. These chapters also record some of the prophet Isaiah's personal interactions with Hezekiah the king, and in the course of those interactions, Isaiah makes a prophecy of the future captivity of the remnant of Judah in Babylon, something which happened about 115 years later. So there were two captivities of Judah, or actually three, because the later captivity is also divided, and this is only the first of them, but it is often overlooked that a significant portion of Judah had been taken captive by the Assyrians and therefore never went to Babylon. So Isaiah had lived to record the fulfillment of some of his own prophecies, just as Jeremiah and Ezekiel had later spent many years warning the people of Judah concerning the Babylonians. And both prophets had lived to see the and record the destruction of Jerusalem. Yet Isaiah, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, had also prophesied many things which he did not live to see, such as the destruction of Tyre in Isaiah chapters 23 and 24, and the destruction of Assyria in Isaiah chapter 10, or the rise of the empire of the Babylonians and their taking of Judah into captivity. That begins in Isaiah chapter 14, and it ends in these chapters here, where Isaiah predicted the, or prophesied, I should say, the taking of Judah into Babylonian captivity. However, the subsequent history of the region had also proven the credibility of those prophecies, the prophecies which Isaiah did not live to see, and his messianic prophecies had mostly been fulfilled in the first ministry of Christ. While we still await the fulfillment of those which have not yet been fulfilled, they are prophesied again by Christ himself in the Revelation. Therefore, we may rest assured that everything which Isaiah had prophesied, which has not yet come to pass, historically or in our own time, such as the destruction of Edom for the controversy of Zion, certainly shall come to pass at some point in the future, without a doubt. But for the moment, as this chapter opens, we learn that Hezekiah, king of Judah, is in the 14th year of his rule. If we accept all of the numbers found in Scripture for the duration of the reigns of David and Solomon, down through this 14th year of Hezekiah, and count them in the most simple manner, then at this point, the kingdom of Judah, attached to Israel or not, is in about its 348th year. Although many of those years were likely to have been only parts of years, so the actual figure is a little lower. It seems also that some rounding may have occurred in ancient records, but we cannot honestly be confident enough to state that as an assertion of fact. Although it does seem unlikely that Saul, David, and Solomon had all ruled for even periods of 40 years. Our 348-year reckoning here does not include the rule of Saul, as we had explained at length in part 60 of our Genesis commentary, a post-Genesis chronology, why we believe that it must be reckoned inclusively with the 450-year period of the Judges. So perhaps we should state here that the Davidic kingdom is in its 348th year. On several occasions, we have already described some of the apparent problems with the generally accepted chronologies of Israel, Judah, and Assyria. Those chronologies usually place the Assyrian destruction of Samaria, which occurred in the first year of Sargon II, in 721 BC, and the failed Assyrian siege of Jerusalem, which had apparently occurred in the third or fourth year of Sennacherib, I should say, in 701 BC. That puts as many as 20 years between the two events. Whereas in Scripture, the first was said to have occurred in the sixth year of Hezekiah, as it is in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 10. But the second in the 14th year of Hezekiah, as it is here in Isaiah chapter 36. And there were only 8 years between the two events, a discrepancy of 12 years. While Sargon II is said to have ruled for 16 years, in the inscriptions which are available to us at the time of this writing, we find explicit mentions only up to his 15th year. But in the annals of Sennacherib, there are only records of his campaigns. And the siege of Jerusalem took place during his third campaign, while it can only be guessed that it had been conducted during his third or perhaps his fourth year. His first campaign against Babylon was described as having occurred at the beginning of his kingship. And from that time, none of his campaigns had been associated with particular years. But from the description of his first two campaigns, estimating the minimum amount of time they must have taken, it is evident that the third campaign could not have begun at least until his third year. So even if Sargon II had ruled for only 15 years, according to a reasonable interpretation of Assyrian chronology, there must have been at least 18 years between the fall of Samaria and the siege of Jerusalem, and that same 10-year discrepancy in the chronologies, which we had evidenced on several occasions earlier in this commentary, and at the end of our Genesis commentary, continues to nag at us. There is a possibility that a record of 2 Kings chapter 18, which was written retrospectively, has some inaccuracies. I can't comment any further on this subject, but it's clear comparing the biblical record, which is mostly derived from 2 Kings chapter 18, to the record in the Assyrian transcriptions, in the Assyrian inscriptions, there is definitely a discrepancy of 10 years and possibly 12, but I have reason to suspect it's 10. And those are the same 10 years, that 10-year discrepancy I've continually come up with since I started examining the chronology more closely with the Genesis commentary. So with this, we shall commence with Isaiah chapter 36. Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, I often say Sennacherib, and I think that's fine, by the way, but Sennacherib, the hard CH is more appropriate, that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. And if you don't know me very well, I usually say Sennacherib because that's the way I started reading it in prison, and I had never heard it anywhere else before I started reading it probably in 1996, the first time I read through the Bible. Hezekiah's father Ahaz had ruled Judah for only 16 years. And according to 2 Kings chapter 18 and 2 Chronicles chapter 29, Hezekiah had been 25 years old when he began to reign. In part 7 of this commentary, titled A Virgin Shall Conceive, and it was Isaiah chapter 7, we discussed the meeting of Ahaz to which Isaiah had brought his own sons and explained how it must have occurred around the third year of the rule of Ahaz, as it is recorded in Isaiah chapter 7. So it is plausible that a young Hezekiah, being about 12 years old at that time, had seen Isaiah and his own sons in the court of Ahaz, his father. However, those earlier chapters of Isaiah also reveal that the prophet had some influence in Jerusalem, and Hezekiah must have been quite familiar with him since Isaiah was no stranger to his father when he was king. Yet, for some reason, even after Isaiah recorded the death of Ahaz in Isaiah chapter 14, Hezekiah has now been king for over 13 years when it's in his 14th year. And this is the first time that the prophet makes any mention of him, except for his introduction in the opening verses of chapter 1, where he had explained the time during which he had prophesied. So it was necessary there for him to mention Hezekiah, but for these last 35 chapters, that's the only time he mentioned Hezekiah, even though at this point Hezekiah has been king for over 13 years. With this event, here in verse 1, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. With this event, Hezekiah had anticipated an attack on Jerusalem. And his actions during this period, as evidenced in Assyrian inscriptions, indicate that he had remained hostile to the Assyrians. He had, after all, the prophecy which Isaiah had uttered earlier in Isaiah chapter 31, where the word of Yahweh had spoken through the prophet and said, "For thus has Yahweh spoken unto me, like as the lion and the young lion roaring on his prey. When a multitude of shepherds is called forth against him, he will not be afraid of their voice, nor abase himself for the noise of them. So shall Yahweh of hosts come down to fight for Mount Zion and for the hill thereof. As birds flying, so will Yahweh of hosts defend Jerusalem. Defending it also, he will deliver it, and passing over, he will preserve it. Turn ye unto him from whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted. For in that day, every man shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which your hands have made unto you for a sin. Then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword, not of a mighty man, and the sword not of a mean man shall devour him. But he shall flee from the sword, and his young man shall be discomfited. And he shall pass over to his stronghold for fear. and his princes shall be afraid of the ensign, saith Yahweh, whose fire is in Zion and his furnace in Jerusalem. So these words may have emboldened Hezekiah and encouraged him to withstand a siege. Therefore, Hezekiah must have also been prepared for the coming siege. And some of what can be described of those preparations are detailed in an article titled The Siloam Inscription by one Paul Harris, which was published in The Open Court, a historical journal which was published periodically from 1887 to 1936, this particular issue in November of 1903. There we read of a water conduit which had been accidentally discovered in Jerusalem in 1880, and an inscription in the tunnel which formed the conduit, and which described aspects of its building. There we read in part, "The water conduit has been assigned to the reign of Hezekiah." And we will amend this after these citations. Because in 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 30, it is stated that this king made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verse 30, we read that he stopped the upper water course of Gihon, which was a spring, and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. It must have been a brook or a stream created by a spring. So they stopped the spring and redirected it underground. But the conduit of our inscription seems to be of an older date, and they're right about that. The work was made by engineers whose knowledge was very incomplete. And a passage in Isaiah chapter 8, verse 6, speaks of the waters of Shiloah, or Siloam, if you will, as it's spelled in the New Testament, that flow gently, implying that an aqueduct must have been in existence at this time. Thus, all we know about the tunnel is the statement of the inscription, and further, that it is older than Isaiah. But Isaiah uttered his prophecy while Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, was still reigning over Israel. They assumed it was older than Isaiah because of the context in which it's mentioned in 2 Kings. That's not necessarily so, but it actually was for another reason. They say, there is another ancient aqueduct which is straight, and we may assume that this later one was built by Hezekiah, while the tunnel inferred to in our inscription may date back to the reign of Solomon, and the tunnel which they had described, which they say dates to the reign of Solomon, it's actually older than that, as we will demonstrate. But they said it dates back to the reign of Solomon, and that's just a guess on their part. They actually described this first older tunnel where the men digging it from both directions at the same time had actually sort of missed each other by several feet and heard each other through the thin wall that was created since they were both digging in opposite directions. And they connected to one another by turning to the right. And that's how it went, and that's how it's mapped, and that's how it's explained. I have links to the original article here that will be in a text. There the article refers to Isaiah chapter 8, where we read, "For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son." So that waters of Shiloah is actually an allegory. And for Jerusalem, for the waters that flow from Jerusalem itself, meaning the word of Yahweh, of course. And these words were spoken to in reference to the apostasy of the people of Samaria and Damascus. Shortly after Isaiah prophesied the demise of their kings in the presence of Ahaz in Isaiah chapter 7. While we do not find a direct correlation to Hezekiah's preparations for the siege in that statement, it is perhaps suggestive of his redirection of the Gihon spring, since that became the source for the pool of Siloam within the city, which is later mentioned in John chapter 9. It is by the waters of Siloam that Yahweh had delivered the people of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah. They were able to have water and withstand the siege. If you don't have water, the siege is over in just a few days. Even earlier than the 1887 discovery of this more ancient conduit, what is assumed to have been Hezekiah's tunnel was discovered from another direction, which we shall describe in part as it is found in a Wikipedia article describing Warren's Shaft. Warren's Shaft is a vertical shaft next to the Gihon Spring, the main source of water of Bronze and Iron Age Jerusalem, discovered in 1867 by British engineer, archaeologist, and military officer Charles Warren. In 2005, archaeologists discovered a massively fortified passage connected to a tower above the Gihon Spring. These fortifications appear to have provided secure surface access to the spring from inside the Middle Bronze Age city wall. And that would be Hezekiah's tunnel, Hezekiah's preparations for this Assyrian siege to disguise the source of the water that was coming into Jerusalem. We would take issue with the article written by Paul Karras, who only guessed that the first older tunnel may date back to the reign of Solomon. If we read 2 Samuel chapter 5, where David had first taken Jebus from the Canaanites, the city which became known as Jerusalem, we read that when David first became king, in Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Judah and Israel. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem under the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spoke unto David, saying, Except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither, thinking, David cannot come in hither. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David. And David said on that day, Whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Wherefore they said, The lame and the blind shall not come into the house. So David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. And David built round about from Milo and inward, and David went on and grew great, and Yahweh of hosts was with him. There it is clear that the earlier existing tunnel must have been from the Canaanite period, even earlier than the time of Solomon, and that David's troops had been able to gain entry into the citadel of the city of the Jebusites, as Jerusalem was known at that time. So evidently, Warren's Shaft had also existed in the Jebusite period, and Hezekiah only took advantage of it rather than having constructed it himself. So we read in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, After these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains, which were without the city, meaning outside of the city. And they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains, and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? Evidently, the Gihon Spring had been situated outside of the walls of Jerusalem, and Hezekiah had stopped it up and redirected its flow through a tunnel under the walls of the city, where it ran into Warren's shaft, from which the people of Jerusalem could take water. This same act prevented the Assyrians from discovering the spring as a source of water for themselves. As 2 Chronicles chapter 32 continues, we read of Hezekiah's other preparations for the anticipated siege. This same Hezekiah also stopped the upper water course of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. On account of his having done that, Jerusalem was better able to withstand the Assyrians because the people had water. And that would have remained unknown to the Assyrians themselves. Here I will, when I post this text at Christigenia this evening, along with this recording, I will embed a brief video at this point in our presentation. It's already a video that's been long posted at Christigenia, I think first in 2010, when I had a discussion of the Assyrian deportations of Judah. And it's titled Warren's Shaft and Hezekiah's Tunnel. However, in spite of his preparations, in 2 Kings chapter 18, Hezekiah is portrayed as having capitulated somewhat to the Assyrians once they had taken Lachish, which they had evidently used as a base of operations. Lachish and also had taken the other fenced cities of Judah. And there, 2 Kings chapter 18, we read in part from verse 14, "And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have offended." So he's being recalcitrant. He's admitting he was wrong, basically, or he erred against the king of Assyria. "Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear." And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. But the biblical accounts do not fully inform us as to how Hezekiah had offended the Assyrians, which is evidently why the fenced cities of Judah had been taken. Although there are references to Egypt here in this chapter, in chapter 36, the full story becomes more apparent from the Assyrian perspective. As 2 Kings chapter 18 continues, it gives an account very much like the one which we read here in the balance of this chapter, except that it is about 10% longer than this one. So presenting the balance of this chapter, we will only mention the few significant differences between the texts of these two chapters. In the Assyrian account of the siege of Jerusalem, which is found in the inscriptions of the annals of Sennacherib, or Sennacherib, it begins where he first embarked on his third military campaign. While in the past, we instead refer to updated translations. I'm sorry. I missed a line. While in the past, we have referred to the translations of Donald David Luckenbill for this information, because even our primary source for Assyrian inscriptions, ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, many of their inscriptions are the translations of their inscriptions are directly from Donald David Luckenbill and his volumes of Assyrian records. So in the past, we have referred to those, but here we are going to instead refer to updated translations from a project of the Museum at the University of Pennsylvania, known as the Openly Rich Annotated Cuneiform Corpus, or ORACC, a resource to which we have only recently been introduced by a good friend. On my third campaign, and there will be citations and actually links to these inscriptions, these translations at ORAC, I should call it, or ORACC. There will be links in our notes, in our footnotes here. So, on my third campaign, I marched to the land Hatti. That's the land of the Hittites. Fear of my lordly brilliance overwhelmed Luli, the king of the city Sidon. Perhaps Sidon was subject to Hatti at one point. I'm not sure. But he's counting Sidon as part of the land of the Hittites, which it had been before the invasions of the children of Israel in the time of Joshua. And he fled afar into the midst of the sea, Luli, the king of Sidon. And we see that the king of Assyria is totally full of himself. Fear of my lordly brilliance. That just makes me laugh and think of some Hollywood fops or something. The awesome terror of the weapon of the god of Asher, my lord, overwhelmed the cities of great Sidon, lesser Sidon, Bet-Zitti, that's Beth-Zitti. I'm not sure which city that refers to. Sarepta, that's the widow of Zarephath. That's Zarephath on the coast near Sidon. Mahaliba, Usu. Usu is the Assyrian name for the mainland city of Tyre. Akzibu and Akko, his fortified cities and fortresses, an area of pastures and water places, resources upon which he relied, and they bowed down at my feet. I placed Tubalu, that's the Assyrian way of spelling Ethbaal, who was the king of Tyre. There were several Ethbaals who were kings of Tyre. The Ethbaal of the time of Ahab and Jezebel. He predates this by just over 200 years. So it's not that Ethbaal. I placed Tubalu on his royal throne over them and imposed upon him tribute and payment in recognition of my lordship to be delivered yearly and without interruption. As for Menuhimu, or Menahem, of the city Samsi Maruna, Tubalu of the city of Sidon, Abdi Levi of the city of Arvad, Urumilki of the city of Byblos, they're all cities on the coast of the Mediterranean in Palestine, northern Palestine, Mitinti of the city of Ashdod, now we're getting a little further south, Budi Il of the city of Bit Aman, Kamasu Nadbi of the land of Moab, Ayaramu of the land of Edom, all of the kings of the land of Amuru, that basically describes all of the kings he just mentioned. They brought extensive gifts, four times the normal amount as their substantial audience gift before me and kissed my feet. The term Amuru was the archaic Assyrian name for Palestine, Lebanon, and portions of Syria, since much of that region had at one time been dominated by the Amorites. And the Assyrians continued to use the name long after the Amorites had been driven out. However, not all of the cities of the coast capitulated, and Sennacherib turned south, where we read. Moreover, as for Sidka, the king of the city Ashkelon, who had not bowed down to my yoke, Ashkelon, the city of the Philistines on the coast, west of Judah. I forcibly removed the gods of his father's house, himself, his wife, his sons, his daughters, his brothers, and other offspring of his father's house, and took him to Assyria. I set Sarulu-Dari, son of Rugibtu, their former king, over the people of the city Ashkelon, and imposed upon him the payment of tribute and gifts in recognition of my lordship, so that he now pulls my yoke. In the course of my campaign, I surrounded, conquered, and plundered the cities. Bit Dagana, that's Beth Dagon, Joppa, Danibarca, and Azuru, the cities of Sidka that had not submitted to me quickly. Then, where the inscription continues, the reason for Hezekiah's admission of having offended the king of Assyria is elucidated. And it further becomes apparent that by his actions, Hezekiah had offended Yahweh his God in addition to the king of Assyria. As for the governors, the nobles, and the people of the city Ekron, who had thrown Paddy, their king, who was bound by treaty and oaths to Assyria, into iron fetters, and who had handed him over to Hezekiah of the land of Judah in a hostile manner, they became frightened on account of the villainous acts they had committed. They formed a confederation with the kings of Egypt and the archers, chariots, and horses of the king of the land of Meluha. That's the Assyrian word for Cush. And we should remember that at this time, kings of Cush had been ruling over Egypt as the, and considered themselves pharaohs, as the 25th dynasty of Egypt. I don't think they numbered them back then, but that's how they are numbered today. Forces without number, and they came to their aid, meaning the Egyptians and the kings of Cush. In the plain of the city Elteca, they sharpened their weapons while drawing up in battle line before me. So Hezekiah, who had been under tribute to the Assyrians, was caught in a conspiracy against the Assyrians and involved in the affairs of the other cities in Levant, which also revolted against their rule, to the point where he was complicit with the Philistines of Ekron, who had overthrown their own king on account of his continued loyalty to Assyria. But even worse, it must have been Hezekiah himself who had beckoned the Pharaoh of Egypt, who was actually a Cushite king who had been occupying Egypt, to come and help him against the Assyrians. This the Assyrians must have discovered either through spies or, more likely, through the Egyptians after they had been defeated. As we read in this inscription that they formed a confederation with the kings of Egypt. So this was also an offense against Yahweh, whom throughout this prophecy of Isaiah had been warning the people of Judah all along not to seek help from the Egyptians. The most recent of these warnings is found in Isaiah chapter 31. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and stay on horses. In other words, rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Yahweh. That is the same chapter where Yahweh had promised to defend Jerusalem as birds flying. And with that and all of the earlier warnings, Hezekiah must have been aware, but he appealed to Egypt in spite of the warnings. Where the same Assyrian inscription continues, we read, with the support of the god Asher, my lord, I fought with and defeated them. In the thicket of battle, I captured alive the Egyptian charioteers and princes, or the sons of the kings, together with the charioteers of the king of the land of Meluha, the king of Cush. I surrounded, conquered, and plundered the cities, Elteca and Timnah, that would be Timnah. I approached the city Ekron, and I killed the governors and nobles who had committed crimes and hung their corpses on towers around the city. I counted the citizens who had committed the criminal acts as booty, and I commanded that the rest of them, those who were not guilty of crimes or wrongdoing, to whom no penalty was due, be allowed to go free. I brought out Paddy their king from the city Jerusalem, and placed him on the lordly throne over them. Then I imposed upon him payment in recognition of my overlordship. It is at this point in history that Sennacherib must have had his officers retrieve Paddy from Jerusalem and turn him over to the Assyrians. I should say at this point in history and scripture. But it is not mentioned here in the texts. This is evident where, according to the Assyrian inscriptions, Paddy was retrieved from Jerusalem shortly before the siege of Jerusalem had begun, but after the defeat of the Egyptians. And that is where we are at here in the analysis of Sennacherib and in Isaiah chapter 36. It is quite likely that while Sennacherib was in Lachish, that there were several exchanges of correspondence between him and Hezekiah, although the scripture only records one. After this exchange here in Isaiah chapter 36, the next time there is interaction between the Assyrians and Judah, the siege of Jerusalem begins. But the event which is next described in the analysis of Sennacherib is the taking of the fenced cities of Judah. As for Hezekiah of the land of Judah, I surrounded and conquered 46 of his fortified walled cities and smaller settlements in their environs, which were without number. By having ramps trodden down and battering rams brought up, the assault of foot soldiers, sapping, breaching, and siege engines. I brought out of them 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, oxen, and sheep and goats, which were without number, and I counted them as booty. The accounts of this event in scripture, as they are found in 2 Kings chapter 18 and 2 Chronicles chapter 32, do not mention the actual number of fenced cities. Neither are the surrounding villages and other small towns mentioned. Evidently, many of the people of Judah may have fled to the south, and others must have resisted and died. But here, over 200,000 of the people of Judah were brought off into captivity and resettled elsewhere in Assyria. This may have been all that Sennacherib had taken from Judah on this campaign, although that is not entirely certain. Having used Lachish as his base of operations, since that town had ultimately submitted to him, as suggested here in verses 1 and 2, where Sennacherib had taken all the fenced cities, and in verse 2, Sennacherib had sent a great army to Jerusalem from Lachish. So in 2 Kings chapter 18, we read, "And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish." And a little further on, "And the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem." In a later Assyrian inscription, which is an epigraph from a relief depicting the conquest of Lachish, we read the following: "Sennacherib, king of the world, king of Assyria, sat upon a Nimet Nimeru throne, and passed in review the booty taken from Lachish. The 200,150 people of Judah seem likely to have been a part of the booty taken from Lachish, as Lachish was the base of operations for the first deportation of Judah by the Assyrians. That may not be all that Sennacherib had taken from Judah, because it says the booty of Lachish, there may have been others, but it seems to be that it is all that he took from Judah, because that's all we have record of. It's just possible there were more. I don't think Lachish was big enough by itself, I seriously doubt it, to contain well over 200,000 people. In a time of war, when your city was being taken, you're going to lose many people. So now, we shall continue with the account in Isaiah from verse 2. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. In 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 17, this Rabshakeh is accompanied by two other officers called Tartan and Rabsaris. These are titles for various Assyrian officers and not personal names. In certain Assyrian inscriptions, the title Rabshakeh is evidently translated as chief cupbearer. This was the same position which the prophet Nehemiah later had in the court of the king of Persia, Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 11. Rabsaris is said to have meant chief officer, and Tartan is said to have been an Assyrian title for a high-ranking military officer. Speaking of the levy which he had imposed upon certain cities, in an inscription of Tiglath-Pileser, so this would be about 45 years at least before this event here in Isaiah chapter 36, we read, from their sheep levy, which I take annually, I apportion 240 sheep as a gift to the god Asher, my lord. From those Arameans whom I deported, I distributed and settled. And there's a break in the inscription, so it's an unknown number of thousands, to the province of the Tertanu, that's the Tartan. 10,000 to the province of the Palace Herald, and then another unknown number of thousands to the province of the chief cupbearer, and another unknown number of thousands to the province of the land Barhalzu. And that's actually a city not far north of Nineveh itself. And 5,000 to the province of the land Mazamua, or Zamua, and that province is near Mane, across the Tigris River and east of Assyria. And I don't have those identifications in my notes. You'll just have to take my word for it, the podcast. I'm sorry. Some of the locations to which these Arameans had been deported are not recognizable names are recognizable names in and around Assyria itself, as I had just mentioned them. But whatever specific office was described by the word Tertanu or Tartan, scholars of the ancient Assyrian cuneiform still have not concluded. Although it is evident here that the Tartan did also have his own province within the empire, here in this inscription. And so did the chief cupbearer, and so did the chief herald. Now Hezekiah did not meet these men himself when they came to the walls of the city, but he had sent his officers. Verse 3. Then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son, which was over the house, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah, Asaph's son, the recorder. Earlier in Isaiah, in chapter 22, there was a burden of the valley of vision, which was actually a prophecy against Judah and Jerusalem, and more specifically against this treasurer, even unto Shebna, which is over the house, referring to the house of the king. Shebna must have been appointed its steward. And we read in part, in verse 20, "And it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with thy robe, and strengthen him with thy girdle, and I will commit thy government into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah." So here, as the prophecy of that chapter continues, the key of David is placed upon Eliakim's shoulder, and although it is difficult to determine with absolute certainty whether the Shebna mentioned here is the same Shebna or Shebna as that earlier chapter in Isaiah, this Shebna may very well be the same man, and perhaps his position over the house of Hezekiah had been eclipsed by Eliakim, who is mentioned first in order here. As we had explained, after the death of Ahaz is recorded in Isaiah chapter 14, it is difficult to determine when it was within this 14-year period, the first 14 years in the time of Hezekiah, that the prophecies in these intervening chapters of Isaiah had been written. For the prophecies from Isaiah chapters 14 through 19, we only know that they were uttered by Isaiah after the death of Ahaz, but before Isaiah had walked naked for 3 years, proclaiming the burdens of Egypt and Cush. And therefore, chapters 20 through 35 were all uttered by him subsequent to those 3 years. That's all we can know. Now, the Assyrian officers address the officers of Hezekiah, and Rabshakeh seems to be the chief among them, since it is he who does the speaking. And Rabshakeh said unto them, Isaiah chapter 36, verse 4, "Say ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? I say, sayest thou, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust, that thou rebellest against me? Lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt, whereon if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh king of Egypt to all that trust in him." The mention of Pharaoh king of Egypt here, in this context, betrays the fact that Hezekiah had a part in the appeal to Egypt, confederate with the Philistines, for which reason the Egyptian armies described in the Assyrian inscription of Sennacherib had come to Palestine to face the Assyrians at El Teca, but they were defeated. So while it is not otherwise recorded in Scripture, Hezekiah certainly did appeal to Egypt, and that was directly contrary to the many warnings he had received in the words of the prophet Isaiah, where Yahweh had warned him not to appeal to Egypt. Here in the words of Rabshakeh, Egypt is a broken reed, because the Assyrians had already recently defeated the Egyptians at El Teca, possibly only weeks before their appearance in Jerusalem. Plausibly, the Assyrians learned from the Egyptians themselves, or perhaps from the people of Ekron, that Hezekiah had been their confederate with the Egyptians. Now Rabshakeh reproaches Yahweh, the God of Judah. Israel's already in, for the most part, not all of them, as we shall see a little later on, But Israel is already deported, and they have no government, and they're approaching the end of that, not quite, but maybe halfway through it, of that 65-year period after which Ephraim would no longer be a nation. But if thou say to me, we trust in Yahweh our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah had taken away, and said to Judah and to Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar? In times of war, it is quite instrumental that opponents have a knowledge of the internal affairs of their enemies, and exploit whatever they can in order to cause internal divisions among them, thereby weakening them. That is the tactic employed here, although it was not employed accurately. Hezekiah did break down many of the altars of Judah, and also those of a reduced Israel, but they were not the altars of Yahweh. In 2 Chronicles chapter 29, we read, in part, and where it speaks of Hezekiah. He, in the first year of his reign, 13 years before this, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of Yahweh and repaired them. From there, the priests and Levites were gathered and sanctified, as if they had laid idle, as it is admitted that Judah had abandoned Yahweh. So in the course of their cleansing and the cleansings of the temple, we read in part, in verse 16 of the chapter, 2 Chronicles chapter 29, and the priests went into the inner part of the house of Yahweh to cleanse it, and brought out all the uncleanness that they found in the temple of Yahweh into the court of the house of Yahweh. And the Levites took it to carry it out abroad into the brook Kidron. The priests had removed all of the idols from the temple and prepared it. So Hezekiah had the priests commence with the sacrifices and offerings to Yahweh, which had been described by the law. Then in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, the feasts were reinstated, where we read in part, and Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh, that they should come to the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem to keep the Passover unto Yahweh, God of Israel. Then finally, we read in chapter 31. Now when all this was finished, meaning the feast, all Israel that were present went out to the cities of Judah and broke the images in pieces and cut down the groves and threw down the high places and the altars out of all Judah and Benjamin, in Ephraim also and Manasseh, until they had utterly destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned, every man to his possession into their own cities. And with this, we may also see that a significant number of the children of Israel were able to remain in the land in the aftermath of the Assyrian deportations, which had taken away most of Israel. I should say the Assyrian invasions and deportations, because a lot of them were taken away with death. So at least this represents most of those who survived the destruction. Some of these, their descendants would become Samaritans later in history, and the apostles of Christ had converted many of their descendants to Christianity, as we read in the earlier chapters of Acts, chapters 8 and 9 in particular, I believe, or 7 and 8. So Hezekiah did not take away the high places of Yahweh, but rather he tore down all the high places of the pagan idols which the children of Israel and Judah had worshipped in their apostasy. But Judah would nevertheless be punished for its sins, as Yahweh had already decreed in the earlier chapters of this book of Isaiah. So the point which Rabshakeh had made is partially valid, because Judah had abandoned their God. but it was inaccurate because he did not distinguish the God of Judah from the idols, which Hezekiah had removed. So he was evidently ignorant of Hezekiah's reforms. Therefore, as he continues, as Rabshakeh continues, he has charged Judah with having abandoned their God and appeals to them on that basis. Verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 36. Now, therefore, give pledges, I pray thee, to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give thee 2,000 horses, if thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants, and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? There is no indication here that an army from Egypt had already been defeated by the Assyrians at El Tekka, but as it is presented in the annals of Sennacherib, that event must have already transpired before the Assyrians had moved on to Lachish. The offer of 2,000 horses is a slight, as Rabshakeh is suggesting that Hezekiah did not have a suitable number of men sufficient to form a small cavalry. Having taken all of the fenced cities and villages of Judah, Hezekiah would already be deprived of much of his prospective army and cavalry. Country boys ride horses, not people in Jerusalem. That's the way it is. It's the way it's always been. Now, Rabshakeh claims to have Yahweh, the God of Judah, on his own side. And he is asserting that Yahweh has abandoned Judah in favor of Assyria, which is a blasphemy that reflects the confidence he has in the mission of his king to control the whole world. Then, at the same time, this is a threat that if Hezekiah did not submit, he and his city would be destroyed by the Assyrians. Here in verse 10, Rabshakeh is still speaking. And now, am I come up without Yahweh against this land to destroy it? And that's a rhetorical question, because he answers, Yahweh said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. And making this threat, Rabshakeh even claimed that Yahweh had spoken to him. But the warning which had accompanied the claim must have troubled the officers of Hezekiah. So they sought to prevent it from reaching the ears of the people. There must have been curious onlookers in Jerusalem who were close enough to the wall of the city to hear this exchange between these men. So the officers of Hezekiah respond to Rabshakeh in verse 11. Then said Eliakim and Shebna and Joah unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, unto thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and speak not to us in the language of Judah. I'm not going to say the language of the Jews, as the King James Version has it, because that's wrong. And speak not to us in the language of Judah in the ears of the people that are on the wall. It is possible that this question was asked in Aramaic so that the people within hearing distance would not know precisely what had been requested. But the mere making of such a plea is an outward display of humiliation and fear. Now, as we have said, it would have been advantageous for the Assyrians to sow division among the people within Jerusalem at this time. And that is how the men are answered. But Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me to thy master and to speak and to thee to speak these words? Has he not sent me to the men that sit upon the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you? These words were purposely meant to shock and strike fear into the hearts of anyone who had heard them. So Rabshakeh reproaches the officers of Hezekiah informing them that he was sent to speak to the people of Judah in general, and not merely to the king. This is a reproach, even if it was not necessarily how or why the embassy was planned. And it was intended to sow discord and division amongst the people in Jerusalem. So now it is magnified. And the weak plea by Eliakim and his companions backfires. Verse 13. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the language of Judah. And he said, "Hear ye the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you." Expressing to Rabshakeh their fears that the people would hear him, Rabshakeh made certain that the people would hear him, so that if Hezekiah refused to yield, perhaps the people themselves would rebel against him from within. But now doing so, Rabshakeh once again reproaches Yahweh their God, evidently esteeming him to have been nothing but an idol, a useless idol, like the gods of the other nations. Verse 15. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. As we have already mentioned here, in Isaiah chapter 31, Yahweh had already promised to defend Jerusalem from the Assyrians. While it is unlikely that Rabshakeh could have known that, even if he had, he would not have respected it. So his plea to the people continues, "Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and eat ye every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his own cistern." This is a promise of peace if the people of Jerusalem submitted themselves to Assyria, even in spite of their king. But what follows is odd. Although Yahweh had often spoken through the mouth of his enemies, or even the mouth of an ass, as in the case of Balaam, the son of Beor, "until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards." The counterpart of this verse in 2 Kings chapter 18 is much longer. Where in verse 32 it continues the sentence and adds, "a land of olive oil and of honey, that ye may live and not die." But at that point, it has text which is very similar to the first clause of verse 18 here, which we haven't yet read, where it continues and reads, "and hearken not unto Hezekiah when he persuades you, saying, Yahweh will deliver us." However, here this Rabshakeh is informing the people of Judah that even if they complied and submitted to the Assyrians, they would nevertheless be deported and relocated to another part of the empire at some later time. This, the Assyrians had been fond of doing so that they could exert demographic control over their subjects, sever them from their roots and their cultural ties, and also, in the extent to which they had believed in gods as pagan, they believed that relocation would also separate the subject peoples from their gods. This is evident in Ezra chapter 4, where certain alien people who were resettled in Israel by the Assyrians had thought that they should abandon their native gods and worship the God of Israel, simply because they were in a land which had formerly belonged to Israel. Where Zerubbabel was about to initiate the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, we read, "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto Yahweh God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asher, which brought us up hither," as late as the time of Esarhaddon, who ruled perhaps from about 20 years after this event here. He was still moving people around in Palestine and bringing other conquered peoples into Palestine. In the ancient pagan world, there is much evidence that the people believed that certain gods were associated with certain geographical areas, even with towns or cities, or portions of cities. Continuing with Rabshakeh's plea to the people of Jerusalem, "Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, Yahweh will deliver us. Have any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad, or Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? And have they delivered Samaria out of my hand?" After Sepharvaim, the Second Kings, in Second Kings, in the counterpart of this verse in chapter 18, we see inserted the words Henna and Iva. These places seem to be otherwise unknown or only tentatively identified, but it is certain that the Iva of 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 34, is the Ava of 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 24. They are the same Hebrew word. So the King James Version translators could not keep the spelling of one Hebrew town consistent between chapters 17 and 18 of the same book. That's sort of sad. Since the Assyrians had conquered Hamath and Arphad, Sepharvaim and Samaria, then the gods of those places must have deserted them in the Assyrian mind. And he makes the same assumption here, that in like manner, Yahweh had deserted Judah and Jerusalem. Now Rabshakeh reproaches Yahweh once again. "Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" Here he presumes that the God of Judah would not even be able to deliver his people because all of the gods of the other nations had failed their own people. This would be the rational Assyrian perspective, if indeed all gods were merely idols. We may only imagine how Rabshakeh must have thought when Jerusalem was delivered. So the officers of Hezekiah stood by helplessly, as Rabshakeh did his best to strike fear in the hearts of the people of Jerusalem. And when he was finished, they did not even respect him with a reply. And we read in verse 21, "But they held their peace and answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was, saying, Answer him not." At this point, the siege of Jerusalem was assured, since the men would not even answer Rabshakeh. But as they went back to make an account to Hezekiah, they must have been disturbed. Then came Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, that was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. The words of Rabshakeh instilled both fear and grief in the officers of Hezekiah, for which reason they rent their clothes. And certainly in the people of Jerusalem who would hear the report from bystanders. There must have been bystanders present whom Rabshakeh had referred to as the people on the wall, or Eliakim would not have requested Rabshakeh to speak in Aramaic rather than Hebrew. Now, the next move belonged to Hezekiah. And as we see in Isaiah chapter 37, on this occasion, he chose to act wisely. This concludes our commentary on Isaiah through chapter 36. Yahweh willing, we will be back next week with chapter 37, or perhaps more, depending on how much I have to say. I never know until I start writing. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel. And good night.